Support comes from Pacific Science Center, celebrating spring at PacSci with butterflies at the Tropical Butterfly House, sea creatures in the saltwater tide pool, and Jane Goodall, Reasons for Hope at the IMAX Theater, a journey around the globe to share good news stories. Learn more at PacSci.org.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. When you hear that a reporter has a beat that is totally focused on a single company, you might think, gee, how can they possibly find enough to write about? That's not a problem when that one company is an all-encompassing mega-giant whose goal appears to be making itself indispensable to modern life. Dana Mattioli is an award-winning journalist who covers Amazon for the Wall Street Journal. That means staying up to date on new ventures, corporate shakeups, and of course, FTC lawsuits. Needless to say, she's very busy. Despite that, she found time to write a book, The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power, was released last week. In it, Mattioli traces the rise of Amazon from its infancy in a Bellevue garage to the sprawling empire of online retail, cloud computing, logistics, and more that we know today. And she's got exclusive looks into how Jeff Bezos' startup selling books online achieved that growth, including hyper-aggressive business practices and culture. Dana Mattioli, thank you very much for being here. I'm excited to talk about the book.
Thanks for having me.
So the Federal Trade Commission sued Amazon last year, alleging it uses illegal practices to maintain a monopoly, gouge third-party sellers, and raise prices for consumers. Just off the bat, how is that FTC case shaping up so far? I mean, I know it's going to be years before it actually goes to trial. There are over a million documents the FTC is combing through. But is anything popping up in the filing so far that indicates how this case could play out?
Well, it's really fascinating, actually. Late last week, kind of buried in the filing, was an FTC motion, which gave some inklings as to how it's going. The FTC basically said that Amazon had destroyed years worth of data pertaining to their lawsuit, so communications, and that it's interesting. Amazon for years had been using Signal, an encrypted messaging app, for their senior team to chat about different issues, including antitrust and deal making, things that the FTC really would have liked to see documents preserved about. You know, it's document destroying. They basically destroyed documents that are germane to the very FTC lawsuit that they're now facing. And it's kind of fascinating that the areas that they decided to take offline and put on the encrypted apps are kind of the areas in the book that we reveal really shocking behaviors, like their M&A apparatus and venture capital and antitrust.
Mm. Is there something about, you know, this practice, the idea that they would use Signal, again, allegedly to hide communications that were pertinent to the FTC investigation, that sheds light on, you know, broader issues with the way that Amazon's leadership approaches the rules that everybody has to play by?
Yeah, I think it's just really indicative of this is like one of the most secretive companies I've ever come across in 18 years as a business reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And it's purposefully secretive and Byzantine to keep a lot of their business practices out of the spotlight that would get scrutiny. And that's what attracted me to covering them in the first place. You know, I was the Wall Street Journal's mergers and acquisitions reporter. And during that time on the beat, I noticed that every company in corporate America was worried about Amazon. It didn't matter if they were even a direct competitor yet. They were worried about Amazon's onslaught. And when I got to investigating the company and getting into why they always seem to win, it did seem like they had their thumb on the scale in a lot of ways that we bring to light in the book.
Can I just dial in on the FTC's case here for a minute? If the FTC's case has merit and Amazon is extorting third-party sellers and inflating prices for consumers because they're able to do that, where are the fat profit margins in online retail? I mean, we usually hear that the biggest profit driver at Amazon is in cloud computing, AWS. What did you find when you looked into the issue of profits and retail at Amazon?
Yeah, there's been this misperception that Amazon's retail side of the business is not very profitable and that AWS, the cloud computing side of it, subsidizes retail. And that was true early on when Amazon was like predatory pricing or undercutting the market. But what we've seen more recently is that the retail side of the business is actually very profitable. Not, you wouldn't know that if you're reading Amazon's earnings reports because it's still very Byzantine, but I got the true internal documents from their what's called an OP1 that shows that actually in 2018, for instance, Amazon said that in North America, its non-AWS businesses had $7.3 billion in profits. The actual documents show that the non-AWS businesses had $17 billion in profits. And what happened there is they actually redistributed a lot of those profits toward money-losing businesses like Alexa. So that's actually the retail side of the business, because they've been able to raise the fees on third-party sellers and make them pay for things like advertising and logistics, is extremely profitable.
Yeah, moving that money back into the development of other sides of the business. And that's something that, you know, goes back to the beginning of the company, which I want to talk to you about in just a minute. What's the significance of that? I mean, you know, how do you expect that to be maybe coming up in the FTC's case as this develops?
Well, I think it's living proof of what the FTC is trying to allege here. Their lawsuit says Amazon is such a powerhouse in online retail. 40% of everything purchased online in the US happens on Amazon.com, that third-party sellers have to be there. And because Amazon knows that those third-party sellers have to be there, it's been able to steadily increase the cost of doing business for those third-party sellers. So a decade ago, Amazon took on average 19% of every sale. For a third-party seller, that's nearly 50% today. So these sellers are having to pay for things like advertising on Amazon, logistics, so they could be part of the Prime program on top of the other fees that Amazon collects. And, you know, when I speak to these sellers about what that means for them, they say that their margins have been compressed and some of them had to raise their prices, meaning that we have to pay more. And, you know, the FTC suit is pretty remarkable in that it claims that prices are not just being raised for shoppers on Amazon.com, but everywhere on the internet.
Before we move on from the FTC case, just for now, because obviously this is going to be an ongoing conversation as the case develops over the years, the prologue of your book looks at the FTC chair, Lina Khan, the youngest chair in the FTC history, that her history as this antitrust scholar at Yale, her famous article on Amazon, comparing that company to Standard Oil in the Yale Law Journal. You know, now she's shooting her shot here. She's making this big swing to rein the company in after years of, you know, looking into it, researching it. And I think much of the conversation, you know, has really focused on, you know, these high fees for third-party sellers. Is that going to be the key here? I mean, what is, in your mind, the key to Lina Khan's success or failure, as a regulator of Amazon?
What's really fascinating about the lawsuit is that it is about consumer prices at the end of the day. And during her tenure, she has sort of railed against what's known as the consumer welfare standard of prior interpretations of antitrust law. For the last 40 years, there's been a change in the interpretation of antitrust law that has focused on consumer prices. And she has largely said that that is misguided and has led to these giant digital monopolies, and that we cannot only look at these companies through their pricing. Ironically, the lawsuit is exactly about that, about pricing for consumers. And I think what's going on here is that, you know, the FTC under Lina Khan has had some losses, especially in the tech sector. They tried to block Facebook's acquisition of Withan Unlimited and they lost. They tried to block Microsoft's acquisition of Activision and they lost. And some of the losses have been based on newer or fringe legal theories that she thinks is how antitrust should be interpreted. You know, Amazon is really her white whale. This is where she made her name in 2017, and I think this is a much more careful lawsuit, and it's predicated on the last 40 years of antitrust theory rather than where she thinks the antitrust theory should go.
How was your experience talking with Amazon for the book? I mean, I know you used to cover mergers and acquisitions, like you mentioned, so you've talked to a lot of companies in your day. How does the access that Amazon granted you compare to when you've been reporting on other companies?
Yeah, so this was not an access journalism sort of book. I reported this book out very independently and spoke to a ton of people. So 600 sources in and around the company, including 17 former and current S team members, which is Amazon's highest level of executive that often reports to Andy Jassy or Jeff Bezos, all without the company's blessing or knowledge. I also had hundreds of pages of internal documents, emails, six pagers, and the like from inside the company that helped me build this narrative. And that was important to me to independently source and report this book. And I, of course, shared all the details with Amazon's PR. I include their comments very generously throughout, but I wanted to tell, and give an unvarnished look into how this company competes and get inside this black box.
Did you ask for an interview with Jeff Bezos, and what was the response?
I did ask for an interview. I was declined. All of the pieces about Bezos and some of the bigger contentions in the book were brought to him by their PR people, and I was given feedback through his representatives, but I did not speak directly to him.
I think most Seattleites are familiar with the broad strokes of Amazon's history, how it grew for years without turning a profit, thanks to venture capital support and tax loopholes, sales tax loopholes in individual states. And thus it was able to gain this edge over brick and mortar competitors all over the country. And you walk through that history. This focus on long-term growth and reinvesting revenues back into the business to fuel the next big project, that's not necessarily a leeway that other public companies enjoyed at the time, the late 90s and early 2000s. Though it's really a model that became more common later for Silicon Valley darlings like Uber. We've talked about that model before, fueling the growth and undercutting competitors. How did Jeff Bezos accomplish that? I mean, was he really just great at managing Wall Street?
This is a little bit of its secret sauce. When I speak to some of the early executives about how Amazon was able, Jeff and Joy Covey, the CFO at the time, was able to convince Wall Street that they didn't have to be given a valuation based on their profits, that bought them years of runway in a way that other companies didn't have. And some of the early employees say, we might not ex have existed had that not been the case. They were able to make the case that this is not a normal retail company. Retail companies then and now have to manage to Wall Street quarter after quarter. If they miss their earnings or if they just don't have profits, that spells bankruptcy down the line, right? You don't just keep getting a higher valuation from your shareholders. But Jeff and Joy were able to tell Wall Street that we will not be turning a profit anytime soon. You should value us based on our growth. And that set them up to just steal share from the malls and the strip centers and all the public companies that they competed against. And one of my favorite parts about this book and reporting it out was speaking to some of those 1990s, early 2000s publicly traded company CEOs. And I'd ask them about what that meant for them. And, they just say you cannot underestimate how much of an advantage that gave Amazon. So the CEO of Linens and Things at the time, I spoke to him. And he said, we knew we needed to have linensandthings.com. Okay. No surprise there. But my board wouldn't give me the money for it. They said you could have $25 million to build out your logistics footprint. And he's like, well, I need $100 million at a minimum. So he said from that point on, they were just behind Amazon from every step of the way. And that sort of dynamic played out at every competitor. Jerry Storch, who was very senior at Target at the time, was reprimanded by his bosses for spending $10,000 on a domain name for Target.com.
That floored me, Dana. The Target CEO was reprimanded over $10,000 on
Right.
Target.com. When you think about the fact that Bezos and Amazon were coming, they were a factor already, and Target is getting
They were there.
pushback. Yeah. Like the idea that, these brands, these brick and mortars, Target, Linens and Things, Barnes and Noble, they had so much head start, name recognition, brand trust, supply chain, everything in their respective corners of the marketplace, but they were still not able to stop this train of Amazon coming through and busting up their business. It's mind-boggling. Like, why couldn't they have that turn with their investors to see, like, this is the next thing we need to invest online?
They were caught in the cycle of managing quarter after quarter to Wall Street. And CEOs, their heads rolled on that metric of whether or not you were hitting your numbers. So the idea of even spending $10,000 on a domain name was anathema for Jeff Bezos's competition.
Yeah.
And they just couldn't get caught up with Amazon. And then from there, the delta only widened because Amazon had these other advantages, like not having to collect sales tax and all these other ways that it was able to just expand that delta.
Yeah. And Bezos was very clear. This is the long game. If you are in it for short-term profits, you are not, you know, going to be happy as an Amazon investor. And he was able to really set that expectation with investors in a way that no other company had that leeway at the time. Of course, now it's become a model for Silicon Valley and other big startups. Bezos, of course, is a key figure in your book. You know, you explore his personality and its impact on the company. You dig into his, quote, Machiavellian streak and discuss really his ruthlessness, though Amazon did push back on your use of that word, ruthless. Mm-hmm. Bezos's hardcore style extended from things like not being willing to foot the bill for late night pizza for his earliest employees when they were pulling all nighters, to what he says to the head of a major brick and mortar retail conglomerate at a convention. You know, your margin is my opportunity. In other words, I will destroy you. And he really does. You know, this was out front from the beginning, his style. But what's important about doing this sort of character study along with the history of Amazon, besides it just being interesting because rich and powerful people are interesting kind of intrinsically?
Yeah, no, I think Jeff Bezos's personality and mindset is directly correlated into the culture at the company. And I found that the culture of the company is where more of the shocking behaviors and maybe anti-competitive behaviors come into play. No, Bezos did. He said, "Your margin is my opportunity." He viewed the world as his oyster. And there's nothing wrong with that, depending on how you go about it. But, you know, there's a scene in the book where Amazon's former CFO says that we viewed total addressable market as everyone else's margins or revenues. And we wanted to go after everything. And they truly do. But Amazon, you know, Jeff could be pretty ruthless or Machiavellian to your point. And they create this culture with some mechanisms that really had unintended consequences. They start stack ranking. So employees are really competing with each other to keep their jobs rather than collaborating. The way that they, you know, they structure their comp, it's backloaded. If you make it to years 3 and 4, you get your payout, but you might not because it's a very grueling culture. And there's a scene early on where Jeff tells the earliest employees that he wants them to have a killer instinct, and he's sort of frustrated that they don't. The company now does. And when you get into the shocking behaviors in the book, I think it's driven by this like Hunger Games sort of environment where employees can be tempted to do things that they're not supposed to be doing, that might be anti-competitive, that might get them into the regulatory hot seat out of self-preservation to keep their jobs or get ahead. And, you know, there's a lot of examples like that.
Yeah. I will say that scene that you relay about one of the early employees in Amazon coming to Jeff and saying, "What if we put Elliott Bay Books out of business?" And Jeff is kind of like, "No, I love Elliott Bay. We wouldn't put them out of business." And of course, you know, they've moved from Pioneer Square to Capitol Hill, but they're still around. But sort of that idea that, you know, even early employees were seeing where this was going, that they were going to end up wiping out a lot of their competitors. You know, I have to say, though, there is this sense that in order to build something, you have to have a streak of ruthlessness. A Bill Gates, a Steve Jobs, they all had their own kind of do what it takes mentality. What makes Bezos different?
You know, it's a good question. I think what makes Amazon different is maybe the extent it will go to. You know, there's another anecdote in the book where they do something where they force a Trader Joe's executive that they hire to give the team all of her documents from Trader Joe's, right? Which when you speak to lawyers about that, that's illegal, first of all. Those are proprietary documents. And it sort of spoke to the ruthlessness, to this drive to win that goes above and beyond. And it was because Amazon was creating a competing product to Trader Joe's and they wanted to crack the top 200 items at the grocer.
That was called Wickedly really, Prime, the Wickedly competing Prime, product yeah. line, which seems to be snacks and things like that.
And oftentimes these things are done with major secrecy, which I think is like a red flag in and of itself for that. So that employee, she found out something was going on because she was hired to join Amazon, flies across the country to move there. And her first week in Seattle, she walks into an office that has craft paper, brown paper covering the windows and doors. That's like a very secret conference room. And she walks in, it's filled with Trader Joe's food. And she starts, it's like a light bulb moment, right? Like, uh-oh, what did I get myself involved in? And it was just this like bullying that happens with her manager. And, you know, someone reports it's illegal because this was not great, a great look ethically, and the team was fired. But people at the company have said that this was emblematic of the working conditions, the pressure they were under, this pressure cooker of an environment. where maybe they wouldn't have done that at another company with a different culture, but at Amazon, they felt like they needed to. And I think it stems from Jeff.
So Amazon did, as you say, pressure that Trader Joe's employee to turn over proprietary documents. And then those documents were shared improperly as well, like between teams, and there were firings, right? I mean, so there does seem to be like some kind of limit that they will hit in these, competitive practices and these kind of hyper-aggressive tactics. I was really interested in how you laid out what happened to Toys R Us and Amazon, because this is sort of an example of the way that in focusing on customer obsession, which Bezos always talks about and he really, built an empire around, that idea of customer obsession allows Amazon to sort of justify almost any kind of practices, according to your reporting, with its partner companies. Tell me the story of Toys R Us and how that sort of is emblematic of what Amazon, the links it would go to focus on what they would say is customer obsession.
Yeah, I mean the customer obsession leadership principle, which is their North Star, is often weaponized depending on who's using it to advance their career or hit their numbers. And Toys R Us is an early example of that. So in the early days of e-commerce, some companies couldn't invest in making e-commerce work for themselves, or they didn't have the technical expertise, so they partnered with Amazon to handle that side of their business, because Amazon had become very good at this. And Toys R Us was an early partner with Amazon, where they were going to let Amazon handle the back end of ToysRUs.com for them. So Toys R Us agreed to pay Amazon $50 million a year for Amazon to handle the back end of the site. Plus, Amazon would get a piece of each sale that was sold on ToysRUs.com. And I had asked someone who worked on the deal for Amazon, like, how did you come up with 50 million? That seems like a lot of money, especially back then. And he said, oh, whenever we struck these deals, we would go to the partner's earnings report and see how much they were losing on e-commerce trying to do it themselves. And we would try to get as close to that number as possible. We come in a little bit lower so that they would lose less money by just paying us for it. But we could just kind of come up with a system for them to pay us pretty hefty sums, which
Yeah.
is pretty fascinating to me.
It didn't matter what it actually cost to do it or what, like a
Right.
quote unquote fair deal would be. Of course, you want to go for the jugular
Whatever you
here.
could extract, you
Yeah.
get. So they set up this partnership under the understanding and agreement that Toys R Us would be the exclusive toy seller on Amazon.com, so that there's like some win-win aspect to this. And it starts off, and Amazon's doing the shipping and whatnot. And then, Amazon also has this marketplace side of the business with third-party sellers, like, someone selling CDs out of their basement, or, a store in Ohio that wants to also have an online presence. And what happens is Toys R Us starts seeing other people's toys on Amazon.com, and they say, this is, you're in breach of our contract here. And Amazon tried to justify it that, well, that's on the third party side of the business. And what happens there is each team has its own incentives. Each team has its own numbers to hit. And I'm sure that marketplace team that had the toys on it were saying, well, the customer wants more selection. So that's customer obsession. But it's not also on the other side of the business, it's not great to your partner that's paying you $50 million a year for the pleasure of being there. So they go to court, and it's this long, lengthy court battle. So Toys R Us winds up winning the lawsuit. And what's kind of amazing to me is that even years later, Bezos is sort of stung by it. So this man, Jerry Storch, becomes the CEO of Toys R Us. Jerry had been at Target for a while prior in a senior role. And it's his first week on the job, and he knows Bezos casually. And his phone rings, and it's Jeff Bezos unannounced saying, hey, how does it feel to work with poor performing people? So like this Machiavellian side shows, and the CEO is sort of taken aback. Like, that's not the normal congratulations call, right? So anyway, that's the Toys R Us story. But
He
I
can't help
spoke.
himself but like taking a swipe, I guess. I mean, that's what that
Yeah.
call
And
says.
it was just remarkable tracking their decline vis-a-vis Amazon's rise from the earliest days. And there's something like that was said in the court transcript from the Toys R Us Amazon lawsuit that really was telling. In court, Toys R Us's CEO at the time, John Eilers, says, we are at a point in the relationship with Amazon where we have no trust whatsoever in dealing with this organization. And that came up so much during my reporting of this book. And that was, back in 2004. Think of what's gone on in the last 20 years. Amazon's dominance has only been more cemented. More people have been forced to work with them. Even their competitors work with one, two, three arms of their octopus, right? And that sort of sentiment has come up so much in reporting out the book.
How has the company changed under Andy Jassy as Bezos is less involved day to day? Or is he less involved day to day? I mean, is he still very much in the decision making?
He's definitely less involved day in day on the big stuff he does weigh in. Listen, the culture is the culture. And even though Jassy and Jeff are different people, the culture remains the same. From what I understand, Jassy is much more diplomatic, has been spending a lot more time on government relations, especially with this antitrust suit. But I haven't really seen that much of a change in the behaviors out of the company yet.
Gosh, Dana Mattioli, we could keep talking all day. This is a fascinating book. I'm really enjoying reading it so far. And best of luck, as you're going out and talking about it. And I hope that we can have you on again really soon to talk about Amazon and all things related. It's a big deal for our region, of course. Dana Mattioli is the author of The Everything War: Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. I appreciate you, Dana. Thank you.
Thanks, Libby.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. By the way, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.